With a nuclear deal kind of, sort of in place, Iran has been at the forefront of the news lately, but our next guest points out it would be a mistake to take the focus off other places on the radar screen, in particular China. Peter Singer is a military expert and futurist at the New America Foundation. He joins me now, a new guest to the Federal Drive, to explain why he believes the Chinese threat is the primary one the United States faces. Peter, good morning. Great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's talk about the general trends driving the military right now. What's going on besides just budget pressure, or is the budget pressure the only thing really driving military affairs right now?
I think the military is facing a real balancing act. So it has everything from the wars of today, so to speak. We're engaged in operations in the Middle East. We've carried out more than 7,000 airstrikes against ISIS. If you can imagine that number, it's incredible. And yet it also has this larger shift back to the risk of great power conflict, something that we thought we'd put in our historic rearview mirror in the 20th century. And yet, as you heard from the upcoming chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he considers Russia the number one threat. In the Pacific, we have an arms race with China. There's no other way to describe it. China's built more warships, more warplanes than any other nation in 2012, 2013, 2014. You get the picture there. And so it's got that kind of balancing act between those. At the same time, it's got a balancing act between generations of technology. So we have a great number of best of the last breed technology, like the F-35 program, you know, over $1 trillion manned jet fighter program that's, you know, of course, had some of its issues. And simultaneous to that, they're trying to figure out how to bring in a new era of drones, cyber warfare, you name it. So it's trying to balance between all of these things. It's a very challenging time.
Because, you know, for the past any number of years, you've heard military leaders talk about they need to be more agile, they need to deal with the asymmetric threat and enemies like ISIS and so forth. But you have to wonder if they really believed it in their hearts of hearts that that was the only way that military was going to be needed in the next however many years.
You hit it exactly. And then you also have a split between their visions of the world, so to speak, or the world that they want, by each of the services. So Navy and Air Force tend to be looking more towards this great power conflict risk in the Pacific, Army consumed by the counterinsurgency, civil wars, and those that demand more troops on the ground. Of course, everything gets framed within the budget pressures that they feel under and the troop cut pressures that they feel under. And, you know, the bigger thing here for the U.S. is that we really haven't exercised our strategic muscles, so to speak, for about a generation in terms of identifying threats, thinking long term about them, not just servicing the inbox. And I don't just mean the military here. It's the same thing on the congressional side, the White House side. And that's really what some of the work that we've been doing is looking at, you know, what does it mean to be entering or re-entering an era of great power competition, political competition, economic competition, and the risk that's real that at one point it could become a not just a cold war, but a hot war, either through an accident or some kind of deliberate choice. What's that kind of, you know, big think, big threat, big war look like?
And you touched on something I wanted to delve into a little bit more, and that is, you know, I remember at one time there were members of Congress, really, you know, conservatives or liberals, as they used to be called, those sound like quaint words now, but who really understood military affairs, cared about them a lot. And do you think right now the DOD and the military establishment really have that counterpart on the Hill that both cares and understands, as opposed to just wanting to cut or just sending the troops?
I don't know if it has the equivalent of it did back during the Cold War. And part of that is just, as I was hitting earlier, you know, not the need for big strategic think. Another part is the change in the presence of veterans, basically because of the end of the draft. And so you have a military that represents a much smaller percentage of the American populace, and in turn, its elected representatives are taken from that smaller number. Although you do have a new generation of veterans coming in the last couple of elections. So you have those issues there. But, you know, I think, you know, one of the other challenges some of the services have been building their credibility on the Hill after some weapons programs that, you know, essentially spiraled out of cost. And so you've seen that kind of tension there. But really, you know, this is not just an issue of Congress. It's as I was hitting before, a larger problem of our body politic, how we, you know, constantly focus on the issue of today, what's in the headlines today, and maybe miss some of the bigger trends that are out there.
We're speaking with Peter Singer, a military expert and futurist at the New America Foundation. And we've been talking about mostly the kinetic aspects of war, but what about the cyber domain, which is probably a bundle of domains in truth? What do you sense there about the scope of the domain and how well the United States military has really fashioned itself to be able to handle what we need in that domain?
The metaphor I like to think about in cyber is that it's akin to us standing in a glass house and working very hard on a stone sharpening kit. So we by far are the most reliant on the internet, include not just in business and communications and whole of government, but also on the military side. 98% of U.S. military communications go over the civilian-owned and operated internet. And we've seen the vulnerabilities in everything from the OPM breach, which, you know, was not about intellectual property theft, was not about stealing people's secrets to, you know, create credit cards. That's why these, you know, hotlines really are beside the point. It was a foreign government penetration, stealing information about employees. It was preparing the battlefield, so to speak. And we've also seen it in our weapons programs. The Pentagon's own weapons tester found, in their words, significant vulnerabilities in every single major weapon system program. And that's what we found. And so the result is that we've seen a wide variety of our next generation weapons that were supposed to put us well ahead of any other adversary get breached. The F-35, to go back to that one, three different occasions. But you also have the risk looming forward that if we were in a war, we'd see something that we talk a lot about, but we haven't seen yet, real cyber war. It is, you know, not just stealing secrets or, you know, ISIS cracked the Twitter feed of the U.S. military and posted the image of a goat. Big deal. I'm talking about actual, you know, carrying out activity that would block military access, shut down weapon systems, basically do to us the kind of things that we did to Iran, the Stuxnet program. That's real cyber war. And that looms. That risk is real.
And it could also be, I guess, wielded against the civilian population by shutting down, for example, the financial system. I mean, if that even happened for 12 hours, there could be mass panic.
You have this risk, and it's what makes the a great power competition, a great power war like we play with in Ghost Fleet, very different, because many leaders think that a battle between a U.S. and a China or a U.S. and a Russia, not only it would be easy, and when I say leaders, I mean leaders on both sides, in D.C. and in Beijing and Moscow. They always think that if a war happened, their side would be the one that would win. It would be short and sharp, to use their kind of words. It would be geographically contained, or it might just be in the South China Sea or the Straits of Taiwan. But when you have something like cyber operations, and the other realm that would play out would be outer space, it would inherently cross borders. It would reach into each other's homelands in a way that didn't even happen back in World War II. And part of this is because of the lack of borders. The other part is how it's just almost impossible to distinguish civilian and military targets when they both depend on the internet in this way. And so it would be the stakes are much, much higher than you would see in the past, and the risk to the broader populace is much greater.
I guess it's time for everybody to reread The Guns of August again, maybe, talk about, you know, it's only going to be a short thing. We'll win and we'll be home in a couple of months. And so let's talk about something you've written about, which is a war. It's a fictional account, and it's called Ghost Fleet. Tell us what the main premise there is.
So Ghost Fleet is a smash-up of two genres, of the techno-thriller style, a early Tom Clancy novel, but a current affairs nonfiction book based on 3.5 years of research. So imagine a lot like Tom Clancy's early Red Storm Rising that looked at the risk of what would happen if the Cold War turned hot. For us, it's what would happen if there was to be a war with a China and a Russia. How would that play out? And rather than following a single character, it plays it out in all the different domains. You know, what will battles in air, land, sea, but also these new spaces we were talking about, cyberspace and outer space, what would those battles look like? But again, it's pulling from the nonfiction side. So while it's meant to be a summer fun read, it also has 400 endnotes to document how every single technology, every trend, even how some of the quotes the characters say are all drawn from the real world.
And so I guess maybe it's a spoiler alert, but who would win in your scenario?
No, if there was a war, no one would win, of course. And, you know, I won't go into more depth on that. But I guess what I would say is in real war and in, I would argue, good fiction, fun summer reads, the story, the best story, the most realistic story is not war begins, everything goes according to plan, the end. That doesn't happen in real war. And when we assume that, we set ourselves up for a fall. And I think we saw that in recent wars in Iraq. And it would be a terrible book if it was just everything played out as expected.
All right. Peter Singer.
It's not.
All right. Well, we'll take a look and maybe I'll review it. Peter Singer is a military expert, author, futurist at New America. Thanks so much for joining me.
Appreciate it. Thank you.